You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Selfishness starts here. Self-esteem as the gateway to successful egoism by Tara Smith.
Let's get into selfishness starts here. Self-esteem as the gateway to successful egoism. Self-esteem as a subject has been kind of fashionable for the last 25 or 30 years. Educators, psychologists have discovered it as a really important psychological attribute for people to have. In particular, they've stressed in young people how crucial it is to develop self-esteem. Yet, despite a lot of attention to it by educators, psychologists, lots of popular commentary, magazine articles on it for about 20 or 30 years, we don't see a great deal of healthy self-esteem in the people around us, I think. I mean, if anything, we've got rampant insecurity. Young people, college-age people, reporting very high levels of anxiety and depression. Among people of all ages, everybody seems in a breathless hurry to prove something, to perform. That's not a sign of a settled, serene self-esteem. Now, people don't talk about self-esteem per se all the time in using that language, but we often talk about people's insecurities. I think that's the language in which we often detect self-esteem deficits in other, oh, she's so sensitive about that. Or, man, she's really touchy, you know. Or we notice it about ourselves sometimes, some of our insecurities. Bleak testimony to the state of people's self-esteem these days, I think, has come during the COVID crisis. The ready acquiescence to authority among so many people. We have witnessed massive submission. You tell us what to do. You know, somebody tell us. Whoever takes charge. We're just awaiting orders. You tell us, we'll submit. Weak self-esteem creates frightened people. Strong leaders, and we've heard about the great leaders out there these days, right? They seem like a lifesaver. They'll take care of us. They'll know what to do, and we'll submit. Now, objectivism views self-esteem as one of the three cardinal values, right? Right up there with reason and purpose, right? We've got self-esteem. So even, I think, among objectivists, I'm not sure that we have the deepest understanding of it. It hasn't gotten a great deal of in-depth attention. Most objectivists' attitude, I think, is, yeah, it's very important, and you need to earn it for yourself. You're not going to get it from your teacher telling you how wonderful you are, giving you the trophy you don't deserve. I think most objectivists, we get that. But I do think, I've come to think in recent years, there's a lot more to it, and understanding this can help us get more out of it. If it is as central a value, as Ayn Rand said, we should want to milk it for all it's worth, okay? So this afternoon, still afternoon, this is not the lecture that I'd originally envisioned or described for various reasons having to do with the quickness with which this was put together, as well as the format here doing this online. It is going to be a little bit different. If you are new to objectivism, this is not an introduction. You definitely need to do more reading and digging, but nor is it just a probing of one or two issues. What I'm doing today, you might think of it as I'm serving up some appetizers, some intellectual appetizers, right? We're going to have a cocktail party later. This is the pre-party. You've heard of the post-party. This is the pre-party, okay? I'm just going to give you little things to nibble on. Okay, teasers for the palate rather than a full course meal. Okay, if you want the wine pairings, you have to come to Austin in person. Okay, this is philosophy takeout. But I really do want you to think more about these things. Okay, I hope that you will do that. So you've got takeout, you've got your handout, I hope. They did distribute and remind you a few times, so I hope you all have the handout. There's that's got not quite an outline, but a list of the main ideas that I will talk about. It also gives you a number of passages from Ayn Rand or others. I'm not going to refer to all of them. I'll refer to a few, but here again, I'd really recommend that you read them all. included is a passage in the essay that Harry Binswanger during his Q&A was strongly recommending, that essay of Ayn Rand's Causality versus Duty. I've got a passage in, you know, from that in there. So that's a plug for, I hope you'll look at this later on. Okay, let me get to what self-esteem is, core account. And I want to begin with the basics. Self-esteem concerns a person's attitude toward himself. It's a fundamental positive self-appraisal. Now, a couple of things to note right off the bat here. It's a global assessment. That is, it's not partial. It's not local. It's not just about, well, you know, I'm a pretty good cook, or I'm a good coach, or I'm a good programmer, I'm a good plumber, good bridge player, whatever. No, it's more holistic than that. It's not task specific or specific to one particular realm, okay? It's about yourself as a whole, in overall character. The other thing is, self-esteem is not an emotion. It's not simply feeling good about yourself. Emotions react to particulars. You know, when Elon did that, I got really mad. I got angry. Okay. I don't mean what Elon did a moment ago. That was good. But, you know, I mean, there's a particular incident that triggers an emotional reaction. Or you might have been elated when you heard the good news. Okay. Self-esteem isn't an emotion. It's more like a mood, you might say. It's more in that, at least in this sense, it's more ongoing. Okay. It's more like a tone of your life, an outlook. An outlook on what? On you and your life. So let's consider some of the canonical statements of self-esteem about it in the objectivist literature. So if you look at passage one on your handout from Ayn Rand, she writes that self-esteem is a person's inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness. Which means is worthy of living. You get that? Okay, I want to make sure you get that. So let me say it again. Self-esteem is a person's inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means is worthy of living. As Dr. Peikoff elaborates, and this is passage 10 on your handout if you're looking, self-esteem is a fundamental positive moral appraisal of oneself, of the process by which one lives, and of the person one thereby becomes. It is the union of two inseparable conclusions, neither of which is innate. I am right, and I am good. I can achieve the best, and I deserve the best I can achieve. I am able to live, and I am worthy of living. What is the self that we are appraising? Well, as Rand writes in Galt's speech, and I'm not going to continue to give you the numbers of all of these, but a lot of these next several things I'll say are also on your handout. Rand writes in Galt's speech, yourself is your mind. And a little bit later, she says, self-esteem is reliance on one's power to think. Dr. Peikoff in number 11, you should judge yourself by a single criterion, your volitional use or misuse of your tool of survival. Since, and again, this is Dr. Peikoff, since the self is the mind, self-esteem is mind esteem. Now, one caution here, don't take this in a reductivist way, that is, as referring to the mind to the exclusion of all other features of a person. Rather, the idea is that one's self is most essentially the mind, because it's the mind, that's the basic determinant of all the other characteristics that you acquire over the course of living. You make your body, for example, right? Through numerous choices about diet and exercise and sleep, just as you make yourself a good cook or a good coach or a good programmer or bridge player or whatever, right? Harry could make himself a good tennis player if he really set his mind to that, but he's got higher priorities, which is good. We're glad of that, Harry. Okay. You make yourself productive or not by the kind of work that you do and the way that you do it. You make yourself just or not by judging people objectively or non-objectively or just abdicating on the whole need to judge, right? The point is, the nerve center of the self, the thing responsible for these characteristics, is use of one's mind. So that's what self-esteem is centered on, right? That's the key way to assess yourself. Are you thinking? Are you thinking purposefully, rationally? Are you consistently exerting the effort? Are you really trying in that respect? Okay. Next, I come to what I think is the hardest part of the material that I'm going to be talking about today. It's the relationship between being able and being worthy, those two elements that I tried to stress in reading some of the passages a minute ago. So if you're following the big ideas list, we're now up to the relationship between being able and worthy. Given that self-esteem involves this twofold conviction of one's ability and worth, I think it's somewhat natural to wonder, so what's the relationship between them? Is one of them prior? Is one of them more significant? Does either depend on the other? So first, let's consider ability. A person's ability to manage his life as a whole, its major constituent goals, career, raising a family, friendships, finances, health, recreation, leisure, the whole gamut, right? Your ability to manage your life. If you want to be happy, you've got to manage your life in ways that can achieve your values, that can make you happy. Thus, you have definite reason to cultivate your basic ability. At the same time, an ability, so let's say, you know, I've become pretty able, an ability only matters if the goal which the ability serves matters. Who cares about being good at something I have no use for? A sense of one's ability will only stoke self-esteem if a person believes he's able to do worthwhile things, right? So worth enters the scene, right? Now we've got worth. Worth. What makes things worthy? How can I be worthy? By living up to morality? That's what a lot of us are taught. That's what most of us are taught in some way, often religious, not necessarily though. But a lot of us are taught, for instance, yeah, you've got to make yourself worthy of God's grace, of God's love, right? But no, that's not the way I or you become worthy, by living up to moral standards. And this is where it gets a little bit tricky, I think. The objectivist ethics holds that each man is an end in himself. Your life is an end in itself. Your happiness is an end in itself. You're not here to serve others, nor to satisfy some freestanding measure of goodness. Correspondingly, the kind of worth salient to self-esteem is that which is worthy of you. If a person seeks his happiness, then certain things position him best to achieve that. And on those grounds, they're worth his effort. Things like what? Certain qualities, certain kinds of actions, things like honesty, justice, integrity, courage, productiveness, perseverance, diligence. My point is, being worthy does not consist of measuring up to some external standard of merit. Rather, the worth that's crucial to self-esteem is the knowledge that you're living your life in a way appropriate to the kind of life that you're after, that you want. Its spirit is, I'm living in a worthwhile way, in a way that's worth my while, given that I want to flourish, I want to be happy. I am worthy of the life that I value because I'm leading my life in the most sensible way to have that. Thus, the connection between these two legs of self-esteem, ability and worth, I think is really tight. And recall, Dr. Peikoff said they were inseparable. So there's still another question that might emerge here. So does this mean that a person earns his worth, that he must prove himself worthy by performing ably? Right? And that the ability issue must be resolved first, with worth then as the later consequence? No, I don't think so. While a sense of your ability will affect your sense of worth, a person's sense of worth does not depend entirely on how he performs. In order to seek anything in the first place, a person must draw on a conviction of the worth of his being happy, his having the life that he wants. He must regard that goal as worthwhile in order to initiate the course of actions aimed to achieve it. He must regard his happiness as an end in itself, his reason for being. He's got to be selfish down to his very core in that way. I mean, I'm tempted to say here, and this is something we might want to talk about a little bit in the question period, but there's a certain kind of self-love that I think that's just got to be axiomatic before these other things enter the scene, okay? And I do want to emphasize that I think this is a somewhat new perspective on the kind of worth that's relevant to self-esteem. It's certainly a radical inversion of the conventional way of thinking of it, of worth. I mean, many people, maybe most people think of self-esteem, or I'm sorry, most people seek self-esteem by trying to live up to standards that they inherit, standards that are decreed by others or that are designed to serve others. I've got to be a good person. A lot of people think, and there's nothing wrong with thinking that in itself, right? But, and these are the benchmarks, these benchmarks that other people set, those are the benchmarks for my being a good person, right? And they subordinate themselves in the process of trying to be good. The assumption is one's own happiness isn't enough. Not enough to justify a certain manner of living. No, no, if you want to be good, you've got to live up to these other external standards. Objectivism declares, oh no, your happiness is enough. That's all the end you need. Now still, since we reject, objectivism rejects, you know, these artificial sovereigns of social standards or intrinsic standards, you might wonder, well, then what, you know, what's really left for a person to be worthy of? Does a person truly need to be worthy? Maybe we don't need that whole idea. But I think you do need to be worthy, not in the sense of worthy by some external yardstick, some freestanding imposer of obligations. Rather, worth must be internal to your own ends and the conditions that reality requires for your attaining them, right? This is causality. Again, you might want to look at that causality versus duty passage, right? If I want certain things, then only certain kinds of actions are worthy of me because they're likely to get me that thing that I want. All right. So the question for a fully committed egoist is not, how can I satisfy the expectations of others? Or how can I satisfy some freestanding, intrinsically compelling obligations? Rather, the question is this worthy of me, of the life that I seek, the kind of life I'm trying to have? Is it worthy of my time, my energy, my attention, my effort? And again, notice how this flips the usual presumption. For its premise is that other things must live up to me rather than I must live up to them, right? It's in this sense that worth is internal to the person's own ends, generated by those ends. There's no such thing as being worthy without a person's commitment to his happiness as his highest good. That's all part of the selfish picture. Okay, that is the hardest part of the discussion tonight, I think. So, next, I want to highlight a few points that are relatively new to me, only in the last couple of years, I would say. And I put these under the heading on your list of ideas, self-esteem as active or as active valuing. Active rather than simply an evaluation of something. When we're talking about self-esteem, and you know, even in describing it and quoting Dr. Peikoff and Ayn Rand, right, we talked about it as an appraisal. But when we're talking about self-esteem, what you esteem is not an object. While self-esteem does reflect an appraisal, it's not a report card. Rather, it's a way of living. And to see this, let's step back a minute. According to Ayn Rand, self-esteem is a major value. What is it to value something? And Greg, in his lecture this morning, was talking about this a little bit, and I think it very much chimes with what I'm saying here. What is it to value something? Well, when you value something, that means you care about it, right? So you might care about your friends, your child, if you have a child, your pet you care about. You care about your career, presumably. You might care about money, right? You might care about your savings. You probably do. You should. When you care about something, when you value something, it means you want it. You want to have it. You want to keep it. You want to nourish it. You want it to prosper. If it's the kind of thing that can prosper, like your child or even your pet, you want your pet healthy and well and happy as pets can be. But what does it mean? It means you do what it takes, right? If you really value something, if you really care about it, you act like it. Valuing isn't passive. It isn't confined to the inner regions of the mind. It's not just an intellectual assent. To value something entails treating it in a certain way and acting to gain or care for it. Correspondingly, self-esteem, self-valuing, is not simply an answer to the question, how would I grade myself? Ooh, yeah, B plus this week, B plus, yeah, no. Rather, self-esteem reflects one's practical response, practical in-action response to, how do I treat myself? How do I treat my life, my time, right? What kinds of goals do I set? What kinds of actions do I demand of myself? What kind do I let myself get away with? These, it's in these answers, I think, in these actions, these are manifestations of self-esteem. It's in the living. Not in how your week looks. If you could, you know, print out a transcript of your grade report and post it on Facebook or one of those things. So let me continue this line of thought a little bit further. I hope you're all still with me. It's very hard. I'm trying not to look at myself and to look at you, but looking at you means looking at this camera. So I hope you're still there and not starting the drinking too early. Okay. So let's continue this line of thought a little bit further. As an activity, as the activity of valuing, self-esteem is not just like esteem for an object. It's not an appraisal of oneself as an object of my attention, right? In the same way that, well, you know, you can show me a painting and I can give you an assessment of it. Oh, that's a really fine painting. Or wow, that's a really impressive building, the Chrysler Building. Or, you know, if I'm a jeweler, I can look at the diamond under the lens and inspect it and give you an appraisal of how much grandma's diamond is worth, right? When you're what you're esteeming, when we're talking about self-esteem, right? What you're esteeming is a living thing, an agent, an acting thing. Moreover, even more interestingly, I think, self-esteem isn't perfectly parallel to esteem that you might have for another person, right? There are people in this room, virtual room now, who I have a great deal of esteem for, right? But my self-esteem isn't just like my esteem for certain other people, okay? I think it's natural to assume that you think, well, self-esteem, it's, you know, it's like my esteem for somebody else, just here applied to myself. But no, they're not equivalent, okay? They're not exact analogs. My esteem for, let's say a colleague at UT or something. I esteem a colleague for who and what he is, you know, the person I observe. So maybe I see the character that he's built. I really esteem him for being a really good teacher, a really dedicated teacher, or he's a really responsible partner when you're partnered on some project with him, or he's a really insightful observer of current events or some combination of different traits, right? Okay, so you esteem a person for definite reasons, but switch to you, yourself, right? In regard to the self, self-esteem means esteem for yourself as a liver, as the leader of your life, not simply as a specimen for observation. You know, I can put Tara under the camera and, you know, do the inspection, print out some report card. No, it's not, because when it comes to you, it's not only for you to appraise yourself, it's for you to lead your life, right? And your self-esteem is a direct function of how you lead it. Now, while it's true that what I observe about another person are many qualities that he is responsible for that result from his choices, although I can have an assessment of him, right? I've got my opinion, my evaluation. I have no control over his actions. Whereas with me, I damn sure do, right? I'm in charge here. When it comes to my esteem for other people, I'm merely a spectator, right? I see the persons they are, the persons they've made themselves, and I appraise accordingly. Like the diamond dealer, he just, you know, he looks and he appraises, okay? When it comes to my esteem for me though, I'm the boss, I'm in charge. I'm the doer who makes myself estimable or not, okay? So the upshot here is, to esteem myself isn't merely to think well of myself. It's to do well with my life, to lead it well. And this means that when the person esteemed isn't someone else, but it's you, self-esteem is life esteem. It's living esteem. My living is the thing that I value. And that's what self-esteem is, valuing my living. The only way to do that is by leading my life, making my choices in a rational, life-enhancing way. That's the way I can be able and worthy, and the way I can know it. So, you should embrace self-esteem as a value, and you should treat it as a value. Again, self-esteem is life esteem. It's my life esteem. Have those hyphenated, okay? My life esteem. And esteeming it, valuing it, consists of acting like I want it. Okay. So, how can you acquire self-esteem? That's what's next up on our list. Next appetizer. How can you acquire self-esteem? I mean, after all, it isn't an appropriate attitude for any old slob to have. So what do I need to do to have it? I mean, I've been talking about that in part. There are, I think, a lot of elements one could discuss in answer to this question. Everything I've been talking about has some implications for this, but here I simply want to raise two thoughts, and they really are things for you to pursue. I'll be pretty brief on these two things concerning independence and indirectness. So first on independence. In objectivism, the virtue that's most associated with self-esteem is pride. And in my discussion of that virtue in my book, The Virtuous Egoist, I link it with self-esteem. I link pride with self-esteem, and I devote a few whole pages, I think several pages, to self-esteem. You can also see Ayn Rand in Galt's Speech links pride with self-esteem. And there's a passage, it's passage 7, if you want to look at that much later on the handout. And while there definitely is a tight connection between that virtue of pride and self-esteem, I've come to appreciate another virtue as also really pivotal to self-esteem, whose influence has been relatively unheralded in this context, at least, and that is the virtue of independence. In fact, I think the two are mutually reinforcing. A person can't enjoy full self-esteem without independence, and a person can't be fully independent, fully first-handed, without a good quotient of self-esteem. But I am going to leave that for you to nibble on further. That maybe isn't even an appetizer. That's more like an amuse-bouche, or whatever those little things are, like one taste. Okay, so that's all you get there. I have a little bit more to say, though, on this other aspect of how you acquire self-esteem, indirectness. The way to gain self-esteem is not to aim directly at it. It's not to aim at, I want to have a positive self-regard. Self-esteem is a result. It's a product of other activities. It's a result of how you lead your life and your knowledge of that, of am I living rationally. It doesn't lie out there like a deer in the woods so that the hunter can train his lens on it. You know, the way that always looks so cool when they show it in movies and they show, you know, with the lens thing and they're just targeting the thing. It doesn't sit out there like that in that kind of way. You can't aim at it in that way. You acquire self-esteem obliquely, you might say, by means of being rational, being honest and productive, by practicing all the principles of rational living. So a related point, the person with healthy self-esteem doesn't go around thinking, oh, I'm pretty terrific. No, that's not his aim. A continual buzz of self-congratulation. I mean, for the person who is secure in his self-esteem, and I think here of Howard Roark, for instance, right? The person secure in his self-esteem, the question doesn't even arise. It's a byproduct to self-esteem. If you asked him about himself, yeah, I guess he'd be aware of his estimate, but self-opinion isn't an issue for him. Valuing his life, that's what he's about, right? That is. And again, yes, it's in the reading of We the Living of the Unconquered yesterday, I was really taken by the self-esteem of Kira in a way that I hadn't been before. And I've long been captivated by dear Kira. But I mean, just this, you know, self-possession, and it's not even an issue. Okay. So next, let me glance at the time a second. Okay. Next, consider what self-esteem provides, or let's consider that, okay? How does the experience of self-esteem advance a person's interest? Now here again, some of the answer I think is fairly apparent from what I've said so far. If self-esteem results from living by reason, then you'll reap all the rewards of doing that, of that. But here, let me focus on one critical feature. It's really important, I think, to understand that self-esteem serves a basic human need. It's not a luxury, it's not a bonus, it's not, you know, an appealing accessory to have at your side. Rather, self-esteem enables a person to pursue an egoistic course, to really consistently pursue it. This is a sense in which it is a gateway, or the gateway. Self-esteem is the confidence in your judgment and worth that renders you able to achieve the things that propel your happiness. Now, why is this a need? Why do we have to have it? In a nutshell, there are a few little elements in this nutshell, okay, but in a nutshell, why do we need it? Because we're volitional. And we know it. And we know that our exercise of volition, our choices, are really important. They carry a profound consequences on the actual way our life goes. Our choices are critical to the kinds of lives that we have, to our course, to our success, to our happiness. Most people recognize, at least implicitly, that it's in their interest to exercise their volitional capacity well. I mean, they may not even know the word volition or think of it in those terms, right? But most people realize, yeah, they've got to make some half-decent decisions if they're going to get half the things they want in life, whatever they want, right? But that kind of awareness or self-awareness creates a need for confidence that we can trust ourselves, that we're in good hands, or more exactly, that we're under the command of a good mind. Look at the passage number 4 on the handout, okay? So I will ask you now to look at that passage. I'm just going to read some high. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I'll read you portions of it. Because she's making this point here, I think. By a feeling he has not learned to identify, man knows that his desperate need of self-esteem is a matter of life or death. As a being of volitional consciousness, he knows that he must know his own value in order to maintain his own life. He knows that he has to be right. And obviously she goes on to say a little bit more. And also look at passage 9 on the handout. I've got there a couple of passages from the journals of Ayn Rand, which bear in mind those were written for her own personal developing of ideas. Okay, those were not written for publication, but in the journals, in number 9, I consider it 9b, the second of the passages I give you there, she writes, the most crucial question man asks of himself is, am I right? An animal cannot conceive of such a question. Man cannot escape it. In one form or another, it rings through his whole life. So part of the reason that self-esteem is a need is the omnipresence of self-appraisal. Some measure of self pervades a person's experience. Let me tell you, I'm judging myself, right? How am I doing? Am I looking at the camera enough? Am I not looking at... Believe me, it's all going on beneath the surface. Believe me. Anyway, and those of us of a certain vintage may recall the old American Express ad. Remember, for the American Express card, don't leave home without it. Well, let me tell you, when it comes to self-esteem, you can't leave home without it. You can't leave home. You can't leave a minute, right, without some assessment. Maybe this just speaks to my own insecurities. But you're constantly, in different ways, I don't mean necessarily moment to moment, but I kid a little bit. You're constantly gauging how you're doing in different respects, right? Every choice a person makes carries little whispers of good, bad, effective, not so effective, worthy of you, not so worthy of you. And this constancy, I think, of measuring makes the assessments especially influential, which in turn makes it especially important to gain the positive self-appraisal that is conducive to success and happiness. Now, again, to be clear, I don't mean that everybody pays conscious attention to his self-esteem. The phenomenon under that label is hardly on everybody's minds. But a person can't avoid having impressions of himself as a life manager, as the leader of his life. He'll notice things like, I keep getting into these nasty arguments with my kids. Or why do I keep alienating the people I work with? Or, I tend to shut down when the going gets hard. I tend to turn away from my goals once I encounter a little bit of resistance, or whatever the different issues might be. We notice these things about ourselves, and the answers to such questions bring repercussions for our subsequent choices, the kinds of values we adopt, and how we go after them. All right. So the simple idea here is deficiencies of self-esteem will hold you back. Self-doubt, second-guessing, again, groundless second-guessing. There are times when you should rationally second-guess yourself, but just a kind of chronic self-doubt or groundless second-guessing, these things prevent you from wholeheartedly acting on your judgment and seeking the sorts of ends that you really should to make yourself as happy as you can be. All right, so to reiterate, what gives rise to the need for self-esteem? The fact of your power to make choices, volition, right? The fact that the use of that power has profound effects on your success, and the fact that you know it, at least implicitly, you're aware of that. That's the reason why the lack of self-esteem, I think, is so acutely felt by people who lack it, are somewhere on the negative side of the continuum, right? Because you know that your use of your mind, that is completely up to you. You don't control what comes of the use of your mind always, right? There are external events beyond your control. It's success or failure out there in the world. You don't control that, but you do determine the core. So consequently, there's nothing else to blame if you're not exercising your mind in the right way. That's your baby. That's on you. Okay, now one last thing on this point before I move on. I said self-esteem fills a need. It's a spiritual need. Just as Ayn Rand spoke of art as a spiritual need, that's the kind of need, the category of needs that I think self-esteem falls into. And to be even more specific, it's a need for what? It's a need for confidence, for belief in yourself, for the conviction that you can achieve values and that you're worth investing in. It provides the emotional and intellectual fuel that's necessary for taking selfish actions, for leading your life as a rational, happiness-achieving egoist. And notice a connection with purpose here, the theme of the conference, right? My issue is somewhat collateral to it, but it's gonna be really hard to be fully committed to essential purpose in life without the conviction of your ability and worth. I mean, good luck with that, okay? With trying to have purpose without really strong self-esteem. Okay, now we get to the easiest part of the evening. afternoon tucking into evening, at least where some of you are, or later where some of you are, but that's good. We love you people who for whom it's 2 a.m. or wherever it is. We love you. Yeah. What explains the prevalence of weak self-esteem? All the insecurities that we seem to observe every day. I mean, I don't know about you, but I see insecurity a lot. Why do so many people have, at best, partial self-esteem? I mean, even a lot of relatively well-adjusted, healthy, strong, able people in so many respects, still, you know, you'll find these real significant deficits or, you know, pockets where they're weak. Why would this be the case? Here again, lots of things can be said in answer to this question that I think have real merit, have aspect facets of the truth to them. Certainly there are some sociological cultural practices that contribute in this country in the last 20 or 30 years. We've got overly protective parenting. We've got all these hovering helicopters around children. We've got unwarranted praise of children, right? The taboo against criticism. God forbid you use red ink on their papers or tell them, no, that's wrong. That's not the right answer. It's kind of a shock when some of my students in college, when I say, no, they've never heard that before. At any rate, that's another story. So, I mean, there are those kinds of things, certainly, but as you and I well know, the answer is deeper. The answer is philosophical, right? What explains the prevalence of weak self-esteem? Premises that you can't live up to. Moral beliefs that impose unrealistic demands. Non-objective standards that set impossible expectations. And I mean, I'm talking, of course, about altruism, which a few of our earlier speakers, Harry Binswanger, started out his talk by talking about altruism. I think Yaron brought it up yesterday in his remarks about how antithetical altruistic ideals are with a commitment to your selfish, this is going to make me happy, purpose. Yeah. You can't live consistently on principles that instruct you to not live, to surrender your well-being for that of others, for something higher. If you endorse such principles then, right? If you really endorse such principles, what do you do? What are your options? Essentially two. You could kill yourself, right? In one dramatic fell swoop, but we don't see a lot of people doing that. Or if you believe those altruistic ideals or profess to or sort of think you do, well, then you cheat, right? You play it both ways. You're sometimes good on those premises and sometimes bad, but you can't escape the knowledge of your cheating, of your failing to live by your principles, right? Again, you'll have those collateral little whispers, I'm not consistent. I don't have integrity. I don't practice what I profess to believe. So I can't honestly respect myself. The fact is, I'm not that good. My altruism makes me not that good. Altruism is a moral code that drives a stake in the possibility of self-respect. That's the reason most people don't have solid self-esteem. They don't deserve it. They can't deserve it on their premises. We've all heard of having the courage of your convictions. Altruism breeds cowards. And most people around us have the cowardice of their convictions, that their convictions require. Their altruistic, self-destructive, self-abnegating convictions. So again, what explains the prevalence of weak self-esteem? At bottom, bad moral philosophy, specifically altruism. Its exaltation of sacrifice. Its command to adopt, excuse me for living, as your regular posture, right? If you accept a standing duty to elevate others over self with the correlative attitude, they deserve it. You know, others should get the best of my efforts more than I do. You're not going to be able to generate the conviction of your own worth. I can't esteem myself if I treat myself as fodder for other superior ends. Self-esteem requires the certainty that my happiness is an end in itself. All right, to wrap up then, a couple of final thoughts. possession of self-esteem is not a guarantee of happiness. You know, things can go wrong. A person can fail to achieve objective values that are really important to his happiness for all sorts of reasons, some utterly beyond his control, some within his influence, but not a function of his level of self-esteem, right? Sometimes I didn't get the job because somebody else was more qualified, or I didn't yet have the training that I might have in 2 or 3 more years, right? So it's not always self-esteem is the culprit, all right? But self-esteem is necessary for happiness. It removes disabling distractions, like trying to prove yourself to other people or to yourself in some way. You get rid of those distractions, then you can focus on the real challenges in life and the merits of your different alternatives and what would be the best goals for me to be aiming at, you know, in this next period of 2 or 3 years or whatever it might be. So in that way, it frees you up such that it, you know, it is the gateway. It is necessary. Okay. And my second final point is just to reiterate, you know, of the various morsels that I've given you that I do hope you will nibble on in your from your intellectual goodie bag, I would especially encourage you to think more about this idea of self-esteem as an active value. Again, it's not a report card. Evaluation is not the point of self-esteem, and a positive self-evaluation shouldn't be the primary aim. The point is living well. Self-esteem is not an end in itself with a high score as the holy grail. It's more like a tool. It's like a tool that helps a person achieve happiness. It's a means. Really, more truly, self-esteem is both a means to happiness and part of happiness. I mean, it is a nice mood to be, like, yeah, you know, I think well of myself, right? So it's part of realizing one's optimal well-being. It's one of the goods you can enjoy that enrich your life. Its reward is in the enjoyment of living your life. Okay, that's my online talk on self-esteem. So I'm now going to be joined by my soon-to-be UT colleague, about which I'm very excited, Greg Salmieri. So Greg, unmute yourself and make yourself visible, I think, please.
Hi, I'm really excited about joining you out in Austin too. And enjoyed this talk.
Thank you.
So we are, Alon, are you going to moderate or should I be moderating, or Tara, how are we handling the questions?
What you prefer. I can help with telling you about the questions or the raised hands, whichever.
Why don't you queue them up?
My preference would be if Alon feeds us some questions so that neither of us is trying to read and make those decisions while we're also trying to think about the actual substance. So if you're willing, Alon, I think that could work well.
Sure. All right. Well, let's start with a written question, and then we'll go. We have a couple of hands raised. We'll alternate. So first question, do you think that it is more difficult to judge yourself objectively, being the judge and the examined at the same time?
That's a really interesting question. You know, one of the things that I didn't talk about in my remarks today, but that I do think is really crucial to self-esteem, and the questioner is obviously picking up on this, is self-awareness. And I think one of the things required for self-esteem is a lot of digging, probing, introspection about yourself. And, you know, in some ways it's hard to be objective about yourself, but I don't actually think it's that hard. It takes a certain courage. Again, I talked about the courage of your conviction. It's like, if I really want what's best for me, then I've got to be honest about, I still have this problem, or I'm still doing that thing that's really not so healthy, you know, or so it takes, it's challenging in some ways maybe, and this is where you want to listen to what other people are telling you about yourself, right? So that, well, now, you know, a few people have said things in this territory, maybe you ought to pay attention there. Maybe at first you were just dismissing that thing that friend one said, but then, you know, what she said in this different context, that sort of resonated and such that maybe I should dig a little bit more. So I think it takes a lot of honesty, but again, you should be motivated by the prize here is my happiness, my having the best life I can. Greg, anything you want to offer on that?
Well, just, I agree with everything you said. And one thing that can help in evaluating yourself objectively is to artificially put yourself in the standpoint of somebody who only has external evidence about you. So you know what's going on in your head, or you think you do, maybe you're right or wrong about it, but just say, you know, if I was so-and-so, Tara saw me show up at the thing and we talked about this and she doesn't know what I was thinking, what would she think of this? How would she rationally and objectively assess this? Yeah. And try to look at yourself from the third person perspective and only go on the external evidence for as a thought experiment for a little while. And then you think, okay, well, I know other things she doesn't about me. Does any of that change what?
Right. Yeah, I agree completely. And one of the things I'm often surprised by is how non-objective people are. That is, how they kind of assume that their own mindset is the mindset that everybody else has, or that everybody else has all the same information. So I think that you got to step to be objective about anything, about yourself, about anything, anyone, any situation. You have to step outside and try to consider, so what's Elon seeing? He doesn't, you know, like, what is what is the evidence that's available to him? What is Greg seeing? What is this questioner seeing? And I think that is a very helpful point. Yeah. With a lot of application.
One of the benefits of it is that it helps you be objective about your interactions with them, which matters even apart from just an assessment of yourself, that you're being fair to the other people and so forth. But it also, the fact that you know that what you're doing is drawing an assessment based on deliberately incomplete information will make it easier to introduce into your mind possibilities that might otherwise seem threatening. And once they're introduced, you can then think about them more easily. Like, if I saw someone else doing what I'm doing now, what would I think of him? And then you think, oh, well, that can't be true of me. Actually, maybe it can be. So when you start then thinking about, you know, well, does what I know about myself change this, add to it, or subtract from it in any way?
All right, I would like to take a question from Melanie. I'm going to allow you to talk, and then maybe you can unmute yourself and give us your question. Your hand was raised.
Can you guys hear us?
Yes, hi.
Okay, hey, this is Naveen here. Hey, Tara, question is, would you say self-esteem is not an assessment of your abilities or an assessment of the success of your actions, but more like an assessment or sum total of an assessment of your actions themselves, in the sense that how rational are you usually in all your actions, or how not evasive you are in different actions? So would you say it's a sum total of how you act in different situations, and it's that feeling about yourself?
So was the contrast between the sum total as opposed to on a particular occasion?
No, the contrast is between the sum total, the assessment of your abilities or the success of your abilities versus just the actions themselves.
Am I doing the best I can? But the honest to God best I can in terms of being rational about my different options and my different choices. So, I mean, I'm not sure I'm quite getting what you're asking, but so let me say a little bit and then you can always fill in some more, right? But it's definitely about yourself as a whole, your track record as a whole, you know, so it's not about how good am I or how skilled am I at this activity or that activity as a philosophical thinker or as a bridge player or as a cook, right? It's not just that, but nor is it about, oh, my potential as a philosopher. It's, my self-esteem is going to be based on, am I doing the things that I really should be doing, given that this is my goal, this is my central career purpose and work purpose that I love and all, right? So it's, in that sense, it's not, you know, am I able to manage my life? That's the meta ability that's in play here. But again, it's, I also want to really stress this idea that it's not simply an assessment, right? When, you know, self-esteem is, I value my life, my living, right? So it's this activity of living my life in a way that gets me the kind of life I want. It's not simply, ooh, what do I think of myself? What grade would I give myself this week or this month? Greg, did you want to add? I just want to use you as, you know, as a supplement here, but I don't mean to put you on the spot all the time.
I would just say that there is such a thing as your character, and there is having the conviction that it's good, and therefore enables you and makes you worthy. And that's not the same thing as having the convictions that the set of actions you've taken are good. But it's taking good actions by which you develop a good character, and a good character makes it easier for you to take good actions. So they're not identical, but they feed into mm-hmm. and out of one another.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a couple of questions from the Q&A module. I'm going to synthesize them together. They're on similar topics. So how can someone build self-esteem if they have either crippling insecurities or mental illness or specifically depression and anxiety? Can you have self-esteem and yet still have sort of these psychological burdens?
Oh boy, I don't know. A good, reasonable question. I think there are levels of serious psychological problems that preclude self-esteem, at least for the time during which the person is really under the grip of certain serious mental illnesses. Again, so much of what we actually, for most people, are somewhere along a continuum in terms of how strong their self-esteem is. It's not, either you have completely secure, firm, solid, thorough, robust self-esteem, or zero. You're just a jangling wreck of nerves or something. And it is the kind of thing that I think there's I don't know if I want to say it's cumulative, or you build it incrementally, and you can get stronger and you can make yourself stronger by doing the kinds of things that I talked about in the lecture, right? By exercising reason, like really full context, demanding your best, your realistic best of yourself, and so on. So those virtues of pride and independence definitely enter into how you can strengthen your self-esteem. But I'm not a psychologist, and I do think there are some people, and sometimes for understandable reasons in terms of the traumas that people might have experienced, the kinds of parenting they got, as children and so on, such that they really are, you might say, crippled by certain kinds of insecurities. And I mean, in those cases, you want to try to find the best therapist you can to work with steadily. I guess I would leave it at that for now. But I appreciate the question.
Yeah. I would add that I think what you need to do in assessing yourself, which is, I agree with Tara, it's not all about, grading yourself, but in seeing, am I being fair to myself, and am I setting goals that I can achieve, and then am I enjoying the having achieved of them and taking the credit I deserve for it? You have to, and the blame I deserve for my failures, for that matter. You have to think about what really is in your choice and what isn't. So for example, if you're crippled in some physical way, you have something ran you over and you now only have one leg, and you have trouble walking or whatever, that shouldn't impact your self-esteem. It's not your choice. And what's a matter of your self-esteem is, well, what have you done about it? Are you trying to make the best life you can, given that you've had this setback and so forth? And you could take a lot of self-esteem in that, and it could, you grow in your assessment of yourself, how you handled this setback. The same thing, I think, can be true of psychological damage and crippling that you overcome and endure and so forth, and make the best of the situation you're in and improve yourself. But the difference with the physical thing, the leg broken versus the psychological problem, is it's very hard with your psychological issues to tell what's in your control and what isn't. So you have to think about, like, is this something that I can control? What is up to me and what isn't? I feel a compulsion to drink or to gamble or not to do this, or I just feel this way whenever I'm in a social situation. What is up to me and what isn't? What can I control directly? What can I control indirectly? What can I change? And it's worth reflecting on that and taking responsibility for the things you can control and the things you can't. And some amount of that you can just do on your own through reflection, but some of it is very, very hard to tell. And what a lot of, I think, psychotherapy as a field needs to do, and what some of the better psychotherapists do, I know my good friend Gina Gorlin's always thinking about this, is, what things are directly in someone's control, what things aren't, how can you tell what is and what isn't, and how can you then take the steps over what you can control? And I think what you want in a therapist is someone who can help you do that, and help you identify what you have control over, what you can be proud of, therefore, when you accomplish it, and what you should sometimes feel guilt over for not accomplishing, mm-hmm. and to distinguish those things and then put you in control. And mm-hmm. sometimes you can do it yourself, but that's one of the things that it's worth seeking help with.
Yeah. Let me also add, just because everybody listening may not be familiar, but the person who Greg just referred to, Gina Gorland, she has given some lectures that are available through ARI on this very topic of self-esteem. And again, she is a psychologist and a therapist. So if people want to look more at some of that, she's done some very good work and some good writing, publications in professional journals.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because my colleague Ben Baer reminded me that this coming Wednesday, he's going to interview Gina Gorland on the issue of self-esteem in the time of the crisis. So you can join us on New Idea Live on Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific. So for those of you.
Good.
All right, let's take another question. I'm going to allow Andrew Traeger. I'm going to open your mic if you can tell us your question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you for the talk. I had a question about, you pointed out self-esteem being important to know that one is right. And, you know, I'm a recovering altruist who's integrating objectivism. And because of my former philosophy, I was wrong a lot in the past. And I do find myself, and I know I'm not alone here, kind of beating myself up a little bit and taking a hit to my self-esteem because of mistakes I made in the past prior to changing my philosophy. I was wrong. I can look back on that and say that objectively in several respects. Do you have any kind of philosophical guidance on how to reorient yourself so that you're not judging yourself for past mistakes?
Well, I think something that Greg said in response to one of the earlier questions is really relevant here. What's within your control and what isn't? And I'm a recovering altruist. Most of us are. You can't hold yourself responsible for what you did not know 10 years ago or 40 years ago, whatever it might be, right? I didn't know then what I know now. I hadn't begun to read Ayn Rand then, what I know now. Therefore, I can't condemn myself for not thinking the things I think now. So more subtleties go into it than that, but you've got to be honest with yourself about, you don't get brownie points for beating yourself up. I mean, you want to understand as fully as you can what's wrong with specific aspects of altruistic ideas. What's right about these ideas that you knew think are, that you now think are right, right? You want to be specific about the ideas and try to understand them in as much depth and about all of their applications. So that's a great thing to be thinking about. It's like, oh yeah, no, that would be doing it out of altruistic duty, but wait, I don't believe that anymore. So I'm not just going to do what my family wants me to do at the holidays or something like that, right? I mean, that's good to get those further applications of the ideas that you're now still in the process of absorbing and digesting and naturalizing, internalizing into your system. But please don't beat yourself up. You know, just be honest with yourself. And I mean, once in a while you will find, oh, I was giving in just in that thing I did 2 weeks ago. I was giving in to some weaker, I don't know, inclinations there that were against my now, you know, what I now really think. So, okay, call yourself out on that, but it's not about beating yourself up. I don't know. I may be picking up a little bit too much just on that particular phrase you use, but I mean, I'm with you, Andrew. We're all recovering.
Also, who's never been wrong about anything? I mean, I don't know anyone who's never made any mistake, but I do know a lot of people who won't admit their mistakes. And it's hard when you think you've been wrong about something important to face that and wonder about it and think it through. And so I think, you know, and the bigger the thing you now think you were wrong about, the more courage it must have taken to face that, think it through, change it, correct it. So you ought to take the credit for making that change and for doing the work it took to address it, and continually give yourself the credit when you do it, as well as if it turns out that you think that some of your past mistakes weren't just honest errors, but were things you could have and should have known better. Okay, note that, but then also note that now you have and you are doing the difficult thing of facing the facts of those things and really doing it. And that's, you know, taking pride in yourself now and taking the credit for doing it. And that's part of what self-esteem is.
All right, let's take a written question. So this one is putting it in the context of today's social media and 24-hour connectedness. So could you comment on self-esteem as it relates to one's comparing oneself with others in this age of social media and sort of connectedness and that entire context?
Yes. It's not essentially comparative. I mean, it's not about how do I rate compared to somebody else? Am I better than him? You know, oh, he's really better than me at this. Man, they like him better. Or that's not what it's about. It's about my relationship with my life. I got it. Here I am. I want it. You know, I'm in year X and I've only got so much time to go. How am I living it? So it's fundamentally, it is not comparative. I think a lot of us are, again, for reasons of upbringing, we're encouraged to always be comparing, or our parents may be comparing and so on. But that stuff is really toxic. It gets you away from the facts about how can I make my life as good as it can be. Now, I mean, sometimes I'm not saying there are never contexts in which it makes any sense to notice I'm not as good at this as somebody else. Well, maybe, I mean, depending on what it is, it might mean, well, maybe I shouldn't go into that line of work or try to do that quite so well if I really think I've got a fundamental disability that's going to get in the way of my being as successful as I can be in a certain area. But, I mean, I don't have anything particular to say about this age of social media where what we did, you know, I gather there's a great deal of this comparing and trying to show off and trying to impress, all of which just sounds like pathetic insecurities on display. You know, just get right with yourself, get right with reality.
I don't have anything to add to that other than Tara's not on Facebook, so she's not my Facebook friend, and I feel
I'm nobody's friend, so myself. There you go.
Her and Ankar, both of them, self-sufficient ego.
But people I love and respect are on Facebook, so I'm not.
All right, we have about 5 minutes. Let me give you two questions at once, and maybe we can plow through some more. So one question is, could you explain why the quote is, yourself is the mind, and not yourself is the content which is in the mind? I think that's seeking a clarification on that. And the second one is, the questioner is asking for a clarification So the question is, you mentioned that one needs strong self-esteem to pursue your purpose. Do people gain self-esteem as they pursue their purpose? Is it somehow reciprocal?
You bet. Definitely reciprocal. I actually had a few lines in that I cut, but I definitely think the relationship is mutually reinforcing, that if you are committed to a purpose and it's a good purpose for you, you've chosen well, you're definitely going to enhance your self-esteem by pursuing that purpose in a rational way. It's definitely enriching and feeding the self-esteem. And even, again, you know, at a much more basic level, when we're talking about young children, and this came up, I think, again, in Harry's talk, this is the first stage to achieving purposes, you know, when you're a full-scale adult and can really think things through and have long-term purposes and so on. But we like efficacy. Why does efficacy feel so good? Why is Greg's baby so excited when it gets to grab the thing that it wants, right? Because it's exerting its power to make the world that it wants. That's wonderful. And I'm going to get to see that now that he's moving to. It's going to be fun. Anyway, I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought there. But yes, I definitely agree with the idea that pursuit of purpose and self-esteem will be mutually reinforcing. You know, earlier I said that I thought the virtue of independence and self-esteem are mutually reinforcing. You're going to find that for all the virtues and the values. They all help each other once they get going. But the first part of your question was about the self. The self is the mind. Why not? It's the content of your mind. If this is what you mean, let me give you an answer that might get to what you mean. Well, your individual self, you know, yourself as Tara, as Greg, as Elon, as whomever, right? Yeah, you know, your character, your individual character is going to be made up of the choices that you have made and the way you have, in effect, not by design, but carved your character, okay? But I think the passage that I was quoting means one's self. You know, a human being's self is the mind, because that is, you know, the thing they control, the method over which you have control, that will make your choices. And then that gives the content of the kinds of choices. So you've become this very dishonest person, or you've become this very diligent person, responsible person, and your brother didn't, or what have you.
Greg, did you want to add to that?
No, nothing to add.
Okay, let's see if we can take one final question. Rivka, I'm going to open your mic if you can tell us your question.
Hello. This was touched on, but I wanted to use the specific word narcissism, and how that relates to self-esteem, how much of it is, let's say, one who is narcissistic, if one can be diagnosed as such. How much of that is one lying to himself, or something else thereof?
Okay. And again, I'm not a psychologist, but I believe that even, and I know I've read this, that a lot of psychologists, credentialed, degreed psychologists, narcissism is seen as a pathology that reveals deficits of self-esteem. And I think rightly so. I mean, as we normally think of the narcissist, the person who's, and that term is used loosely, widely, sloppily applied. So I think there is a technical, psychological definition of it, as well as some looser uses of it that people make. But as that term is often applied, it's applied to people who are very concerned about what they look like, or preening, or a kind of self-absorption to the exclusion of other people, and so on. None of which is objectively valuable, is objectively helping them actually attain a happy life, a flourishing life. So narcissism is definitely a problem. It has nothing to do, I think, with genuine self-esteem. And I think that's part of what you're getting at in asking the question. Greg, you may have things to add on this.
Yeah, I mean, there's this diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder and so forth. And I think you'd really need to know more about psychology than I do to talk about it. But if you think about the kind of person who's stereotypically diagnosed that way by amateur people looking on the internet and saying, this guy's NPD or a narcissist, or how the term's used when you dismiss somebody and put away, is there an actual psychological condition? But that kind of guy, that kind of trait, to somebody who's very touchy, he makes everything about him. He's always worried that there's a kind of slight against him. He interprets every situation through that. We're here to get a certain job done. And people ask questions about that, but he's always much more interested in how is he being perceived and telling you what a good job he's doing than actually doing the job. That, all of those things, that touchiness, that is a clear case of something that could only come from a lack of self-esteem. Yeah. If you have self-esteem, you're not preoccupied with, am I good enough? Do people think I'm
exactly
great? Recognize how I am. Yeah. And if you don't, you are preoccupied with that by necessity. Right.
No, it's that comparative thing again, too. It's like, how do I look? How do I measure up? You know, deficits of self-esteem are a big distraction, because you are, as Greg was saying, right, there's this shadow agenda you've always got. You've got to prove yourself. You've got to prove yourself as good enough. It gets in the way. And this is why it's important, you know, it's wonderful to have self-esteem. It's also wonderful that the people you hang out with or work with have self-esteem, because to the extent they don't, they are always going to be these insecure people who are touchy, or who have to be coddled, or have to be stroked, and so on. And it takes the attention and energy away from whatever the real issues are that you're, you know, that you need to decide on at a meeting or what have you. So anyway.
Well, thank you, Tara, and thank you, Greg. It's been a wonderful presentation. We have more questions than we were able to get to. I appreciate you taking the time.
Sure. If I may say so, you know, even online, when I can't see your faces, you guys are so much fun to be with. So thank you. So come to Austin as soon as you can.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.